Good morning. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. I'm your host, Nick Shutt. Happy to have my buddy Nick Tabal with me here today. Nick, how are you doing this morning?
Hey Nick, I'm good. Good. Good to be here.
I appreciate you coming on, man. I appreciate you coming on. You know it's gonna be good when there's two Nicks on the call, right? Like that's always a good, that's a great starting point, you know?
That is a great starting point. Yeah, and thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely, man. If you don't mind, just like to start, would you tell myself and the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you've been doing, and kind of how you got here, man?
Sure. So, well, first of all, we're almost neighbors. We live like a mile apart in Columbia, Virginia. I studied mechanical engineering in the UK, but most of my career has been around data. And so data has been kind of a central theme throughout my career. A lot of measurement, so measuring sales in grocery stores. I was part of the kind of the internet from the very early stages, measuring how people use the internet, and then most recently in space. So I kind of see data as a raw material that the mechanical engineer might use. So when I see data, I kind of picture what the end state looks like, and then kind of figure out what you need to do to it to extract value from it or build better products. It's actually it's similar to like how Amazon looks at new services and products that they're launching. Whenever they think of one, they think of the end state, and then they're like, okay, what's the press release going to look like? And then they go back. So in my mind, and I'd like to say way before Amazon came up with that, I look at data and I think, okay, this is what it's going to look like, and then go back and figure out the process. So most recently, I worked for a couple of space companies, Continuum Space Systems and BlackSky. BlackSky is a satellite imagery company. Continuum Space is a software company that helps with designing space missions. And before that, I did a lot of work with the internet and online advertising.
That's really cool, man. No, that's fair. And I love how you I love what you said about how, you start with the end state and you work backwards. I always think that like you don't have to, I don't know how like exactly how granular it needs to be when you're looking at data, but like it's, I always tell people like when you're starting a business or if you're, if you're even if you like you need to know where you're going. It's like if you don't know your end destination before you start driving, that's like driving just driving to drive, right? So I absolutely think, working backwards is 1,000% value, but you have to have that mission in mind. Really cool. So, what are some of the how is data and how is it really used in space specifically, whether it's software or imagery, and can you give folks like a lay of the land about what that looks like at this point?
Sure. So, well, I'll start with the satellites. First of all, you got two major types of satellites: satellites that take images and satellites that help with communication. My experiences with satellites that take images, they're generally in low Earth orbit, so about 300 miles up in the air. And just for and they kind of rotate around the Earth every hour and a half. And just for comparison, a lot of the communication satellites, particularly let's say the ones that beam NFL games, they're geostationary. They're way up there, like thousands, maybe 10,000 miles up there, and they always stay in the same location relative to Earth. Now with Starlink, there are more satellite communication satellites in low Earth orbit. But anyway, with imagery, So they're 300 miles up there. They're going at seven at 25 times the speed of sound, 17,000 miles an hour. And they can lock onto a place long enough to take an image. It's really kind of cool. So governments have had them for a long time, but commercial companies, when they started launching imagery satellites, they were primarily used for mapping, right? So Google Maps used satellite imagery. Today, Google Maps actually uses aerial photography because they can get much higher resolutions for cities in Google Maps. So it started out as mapping missions for the government and for people like Google Maps and Apple Maps. And then actually BlackSky came up with a really interesting idea, which is instead of sending satellites over the North and South Pole, so you can s essentially over time see every square inch on Earth, they put them over the most populated parts of this globe. So mostly plus to minus 50 degrees. BlackSky launched a bunch of them. So what we were able to do is see places on Earth multiple times a day, like up to 10 times a day. So then it becomes a really interesting way to see what's changing on Earth. So that's kind of the satellite world. A lot of satellite companies do a lot of business with governments, but they also do business with commercial companies. Further than low Earth orbit, than LEO, there are a lot of great ideas. And so far, it's much more kind of nascent. It's much more in its infancy, that whole ecosystem. NASA basically said they want to have a permanent human presence on the moon. So there's a lot of effort with figuring out how do you keep people alive on the surface of the moon? How do you generate power? What happens if an asteroid hits the moon, right? And that's why the surface is all has all these potholes because of asteroids. Because there's no atmosphere. And then there are a bunch of people doing stuff in deep space, figuring out how to mine asteroids, how to build stuff in space, how to. There's a company that's manufacturing medicine in space. Because if you manufacture medicine in microgravity or almost no gravity, you can create these molecules that are kind of perfectly symmetrical,
Interesting.
and they can be more effective. So that's actually an interesting development that could that I think is worth watching.
No, that's really, really cool. I think obviously if we ever want to become a multiplanetary species, we need to figure out how to survive in space, right? And so
Right. And essentially the moon becomes a pit stop,
Yeah, it's a gas.
right? Or low Earth orbit becomes a pit stop. Let's say if you want to go to Mars, I think Mars is much more interesting than the moon. If you can manufacture stuff in low Earth orbit or on the moon, then you save a lot of cost and time and energy.
Right, and then and then you can essentially not have to pay to get it out of Earth, like get it out of, the atmosphere here on Earth
Yeah,
and save.
gravity and atmosphere and all of that stuff.
Absolutely, 1,000%, man. No, that's really cool. I appreciate that. And how have you seen like AI and recently AI, but like data at large and machine learning, how has that changed this field, man? How has it changed geospatial analytics? And where do you think it's going?
So, BlackSky is one of those companies that I think approached AI the right way. partly because they wanted to approach it the right way, they had the right talent, but also they had raw materials, which is a lot of images. So from the beginning, Black Sky's vision was to automate a lot of the stuff, right? So you end up taking multiple images a day of dozens, let's say dozens and dozens of locations, and you're using AI to, first of all, identify things of interest, like maybe they're ships, maybe they're planes, and then identify what's changed. And there's this thing, it's not enough to say there were three airplanes and now there were three airplanes yesterday and there are three airplanes this morning. You want to know if they're the same or not, right? That's actually valuable information. So in the industry, they use this thing where red is fled and blue is new. So if you highlight something today, oh no, from yesterday, you highlight yesterday's image, anything that's in red, it means it disappeared between yesterday and today. And in today's image, blue is new. So if something's highlighted in blue, it means it wasn't there yesterday. So the idea of using AI, and this is like a true use of AI for kind of computer vision, train a lot of models, start with thousands, maybe tens of thousands of images, train them, or train the models so you can accurately identify airplanes. And you want to identify airplanes from like small fighter jets to big cargo planes. Right? And you want to know if it's the same plane as yesterday. Also, you have to train it in all kinds of conditions. Airplanes look different in the desert than they do in a snowy area. Russian planes look different than Chinese planes. So you train all of that, and you want to get to a point where you're seeing something, or the computer seeing something and is confidently saying, this is anomalous, this is not normal. All of a sudden, a bunch of airplanes disappeared, or all of a sudden, there's a bunch of new airplanes here. So that's kind of that's the dream. The problem is, you've got in a lot of governments, you've got a lot of human analysts that are analyzing images, and they need to get comfortable that these AI models, computer vision models, are accurate enough that they're not missing anything critical.
Are those algorithms accurate enough now to not miss anything critical? Or can you not tell me that?
I can't, I don't know. I left Black Sky a year ago. I don't know how much progress has been made. I know some companies are better than others, but I don't know how government, how analysts, geospatial analysts or imagery analysts, feel about the models today. Some are better than others. And Black Sky is kind of, well, when you're a satellite company, you have an advantage because you can train your models off of a bunch of historical data. Whereas if you're an analytics company, you have to buy or figure out how to get access to thousands of images.
That makes sense.
But the next step after that is edge processing. So putting processors on the satellites themselves, so you can run these models on the satellite and only download critical information. The way a satellite works is, I sit here and put in a tasking order to collect an image that's over my house, right? And there's an algorithm that decides, if it's time to take my image, or if there's a higher priority image that it needs to capture first. So that algorithm runs, and then it needs to send the signal up to the satellite, say, here are the images you're capturing for the next whatever, 20 minutes, let's say. So it goes to a ground station, then up, it captures the images, and then it needs to beam the images back down to another ground station. That takes a while to beam an image down. So what if you could actually process the results up on the satellite itself and only download the area that's changed, right? Then you can start getting results much more quickly. Or a lot of companies are looking at using other satellites, or either communicating in between your satellites or communicating with SATCOM satellites to actually beam the image down even before that satellite goes over the next ground station. So that's another area that's kind of where there's a lot of work and a lot of progress. From a space perspective, when I was at Continuum Space, there's a big program from Space Force called R2C2, Rapid and Responsive Command and Control. And there's a lot of so if there's a threat in space, they want to be able to figure out very quickly, if you need to launch something, what do you need to launch? Where do you launch it from? What's the optimal trajectory, and how do you get there? There's a lot of kind of AI and autonomy that's involved in that. That's a very large program that's just starting, and like I don't know exactly. I can't talk about details, but there's a lot of kind of autonomous stuff that they're looking at, which is really interesting. And then there's stuff like, let's say you have a satellite in space and there's an object that appears to be coming towards your satellite. You need to predict whether it's debris or something that's actually aiming at your satellite, and whether you need to adjust your orbit, you know, what you need to do about that. So,
That's
all of that stuff, really exciting stuff.
that is really exciting. I feel like whoever named that program is a massive Star Wars fan first. But that's I don't actually I didn't actually know much about that. That's really cool. And it makes sense that you would need to obviously predict all this, and having that processing power on the satellite would absolutely 1,000%. I mean, it's because it's all about latency, right? And you'd want to make sure that there's enough time for you to, if it's like, if there's something coming, to adjust so you don't damage the satellite, right?
And actually, as you start going to the moon and to deep space, right, it takes time for a message to get from Earth to the moon. So you need autonomous systems that can, make decisions on their own until you're able to interfere if you need to do that.
Absolutely. No, 100%. And what do you think, like, when you start looking at establishing populations on the moon, and sustaining that, how first, I mean, what can you estimate how long it'll be before that's like a realistic thing? And then, I mean, that it also just sounds, it sounds really real, like really cool, but like really high risk. There's not a lot of margin for error, and I think that that would slow it down, right?
I don't know when populations are going to be there, but I think, the International Space Station is 25 years old. It's probably got 5 more years left. I think its successor will likely be on the moon. There may be some private space stations that are in low Earth orbit, but I think what NASA is trying to establish is having astronauts permanently present on the moon. And I mean, they need it's a very dusty environment. So even if you have solar power, you need to figure out how to clear the dust off of the solar panels. And then also water and oxygen, right? Which is are critical, and that's why a lot of countries are trying to figure out how much ice is on the moon. Because once you find ice, you can make water and oxygen. So I think they need to answer questions like that and figure out how to build stuff on the moon before you figure out how do you get to the next planet and how do you get more people there. I don't know if we'll see that in our lifetime. Maybe. I
Maybe.
don't
Yeah.
know.
What No, and how, do you think that a lot of these like computer vision algorithms, things like that, can we teach them to help look for, stuff on the moon? I assume we can if we put satellites in orbit around the moon. I don't know if we have them though. I would assume that's a
We
possibility.
do have, I believe that there are satellites around the moon. NASA has satellites around the moon that and they've mapped big parts of the moon. But like I said earlier, the surface is full of potholes. So there was one of the we sent a private company that's working with NASA sent like a rover to the moon, but when it landed, it kind of tipped over on its side. So I mean that's a real risk. So there is data about the surface of the moon, but it's also pretty kind of inhospitable. The temperatures vary greatly. Between night and day, like for the 14-day night, there's a better way to say this, but a night lasts 14 days. It's super cold when it's nighttime, so they also need to figure out how to kind of regulate the temperatures for astronauts and how to manufacture stuff. So there's a lot of data, but there's a long, long way to go. But
Absolutely.
it's just really exciting to see all of that progress.
Absolutely. And how is it? How is the public-private partnership, how is that changing and evolving through, through this process?
Well, NASA used to build everything themselves, and now with Artemis, which is the effort to kind of have sustained human presence on the moon, they're using a whole bunch of companies. And the way they look at it is, in the past they used to take one shot on goal, and now they're taking multiple shots on goal. So they're working with a lot of space companies. They've had some successes and some failures. But they're expecting failures, and they're kind of and they're pushing on. I think there are some delays with this program. There are delays with a lot of big programs. But yeah, they're working with a bunch of companies. So SpaceX and Blue Origin will be flying rockets to the moon. Various companies will have different payloads on them. And it's all kind of orchestrated by NASA.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Do you think that's a better way than NASA building everything themselves?
Yes, I mean, I'm not an expert at this stuff, but to me, it seems like a better, faster way to do things. But I do think everyone's learning to work with each other. the government's learning to work with all of these space startups, and space startups are learning to work with the government. The problem is, if NASA experiences a delay, then it's like a 1 year delay. Well, a 1 year delay could kill a startup. So, but everyone's got best intentions at heart, and they're all kind of trying to make it work
Absolutely.
and learn from mistakes and do better kind of with the next iteration.
Absolutely. And how do you think that you know we're gonna what are some of the things that you're most excited about, Nick, when you think about, because this is all very exciting, whether you want to talk about you know decreasing latency between satellites or you know people on the moon, astronauts on the moon, you know, looking at exploring in deep space and beyond, whether it's going to Mars or figuring out how to either capture asteroids or go mine them and bring material, you know, bring resources back to Earth that are scarce here. Like I know, is it helium 3 that's on the moon that there's to, or is that what it, yeah.
Yes.
And so it's huge quantities there, very limited on Earth, and we're looking to try to mine that. Obviously, there's all. All of this is, I mean, it was science fiction, you know, 40 years ago, and now we're like actually starting to do it, and it's really cool to see happen. But what are some of the things that you're most excited about?
I think ultimately getting to Mars would be really cool, and figuring out how to make people survive in inhospitable environments. I'd also like to see satellite companies make more money. Right now, so, well, right now, space beyond low Earth orbit, really a lot of the spend comes from NASA, Space Force, the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency. In the satellite world, there's a bigger economy, but still, I mean, you look at kind of satellite companies that are public, and they're struggling to make money. I'd like to see them start to become profitable. I think part of the problem is, government agencies want to work with private companies, and they're trying to figure it out. Right, they kind of go back and forth of like, well, how much do I want to spend with commercial companies? How many satellites do I want to build myself? This is not just the US, it's kind of all of the major countries. And then on the commercial side, I don't think anyone's cracked the code yet. Any of the satellite companies have cracked the code as to how to do business with commercial companies. I mean, Planet has the Dove satellites, which are slightly lower resolution, and they kind of sell subscription services. But for example, traders, people who trade oil, or even coal, or a bunch of raw materials, they could use satellite imagery to track the movement of these raw materials from production to the problem is it costs a lot of money, because every image costs, a few hundred to a few thousand dollars. And they haven't kind of figured out how to use remote sensing effectively enough to solve some bigger problems. Bigger kind of economic problems. And I think once they crack that code, hopefully we'll see more of these satellite companies become profitable.
Right.
mean, also,
So that you can take
with
advantage.
the advancements in technology,
Yeah.
new satellites are more powerful and cheaper and smaller than older satellites, but that also takes time, right? It takes years to design a satellite and
And design it and set
also.
up everything. You mentioned you mentioned to me when we had, I think when we had coffee a couple of weeks ago, that you that we are able to now you essentially have solar panels in orbit. Is that, can you talk about like what that is a little bit and explain it to folks?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, what one way to think about it is, sun's very powerful, and the atmosphere absorbs a lot of that energy. And so, what if you could generate energy in on orbit and then beam it down to Earth? And there are really kind of a few ways to do that. You could have a satellite that has mirrors and is redirecting the Earth's rays to Earth, like in a concentrated fashion. And I think there's a company called Reflect Orbital that's doing that. And if you're smart about it, you could even redirect those rays to a power station at night. The problem is, if anyone flies through this, they'll be fried. Or I don't know what'll happen to them, but they'll probably spontaneously combust.
Right. It's like
Right?
it's
So,
using the magnifying glass to focus the sun beam when you're a little kid, but w way, way, way bigger scale.
right. So I'm not an expert at this stuff, but there are companies trying to do that. So redirect the rays down to Earth. A second one is you have solar panels in space that are capturing the sun's energy, turning it to electro. Well, really, they're going to turn it into microwaves and then the microwaves down to Earth.
Yeah.
Um,
Same thing though. Like,
and
yeah.
uh, Caltech has done a couple of tests with that.
Really.
And they've managed to do it. Now, the question is, how do you do that at scale? And again, what happens if someone passes through this microwave beam? And I'm again not an expert at this stuff, but I'm sure like it's not going to be good. So you need to kind of figure out how to safely get that energy from low Earth orbit 300 miles down to Earth. And make sure you're not killing birds, people, planes, whatever. And then there's another way to do it. It doesn't actually involve space, but it's to transmit electricity from one place to the next. Like, you look at deserts, there's a lot of sun in deserts, right? You produce a lot more energy than you can consume. So what if you could start distributing that energy? And there is, I believe there's a trial going on where they're trying to connect the UK and New York. Because, what's interesting is kind of peak demand for energy is early in the morning and then late in the afternoon. But peak supply from solar is noon, is like around the middle of the day, right? So if you look at London and New York, it's kind of, when it's around noon in Europe, it's morning in New York. When it's around noon in New York, it's kind of evening in Europe. So that's another way that people are kind of trying to figure this out. And do you do it through cables? Do you do it through wireless transmission? I think that's what people are trying to figure out.
Absolutely.
Actually, on a similar note, I was I was reading up on solar energy for homes, and really what will have the biggest impact is not just having solar panels and on a home, but it's actually having solar panels and batteries. Because generating all this extra electricity at noon, particularly for homes, is not super valuable. But charging up at noon so that people can use that electricity when they come home from work, that will actually free up power stations to produce more energy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's kind of a big opportunity with solar power at homes. It's to have more batteries and kind of distribute power usage and generation slash storage more effectively.
Yeah,
But
absolutely. As batteries,
yeah, wouldn't it be cool to just beam energy down?
that would be really cool. That would be really, really cool. And the thing, so like the thing that I have thought about since we had that conversation, is like, what happens if, whether you want to be beaming microwaves or redirecting sunlight to solar panels, either or what happens if like the satellite malfunctions and is non-responsive, and all of a sudden it's beam it just goes off track, right? Like, and goes through a city somewhere or something. Like, that's just terrifying. There again, just with space, it seems like there's just very little margin for error.
There is. Well, with this particular example, right, something goes wrong and you can potentially hurt people. Things go wrong a lot of the time in space. It's risky. It's timelines are long, but generally when things go wrong in space, that problem stays in space. Although, it's now generated a lot of debris, which is becoming a bigger problem, which I think governments need to take a more active role in.
I agree.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool, man. It'd be really cool if we could, just generate power that way. But, I think that's a couple years off at least. But that would make space more economically viable, right? And like, that would be a huge thing if we could generate power from, in space. And and then obviously, like, mining operations, re other resource gathering, I think, is another huge opportunity. But there's just a huge gulf of technology that needs to be developed and problems that need to be solved before we can actually do that in a sustainable way. So,
Right.
but yeah, man, one of the things that, another thing you and I share a real passion for is is wine specifically, man. So how do you think AI is working in and around the wine industry, whether it be retail or, production side, and how can those, to interact and enhance each other, let's say.
Well, so yeah, I love wine, and somewhere down the road I might get involved in the wine industry. But I think in its most basic form, AI is helping actually wine, but also a lot of other industries become kind of help people set things up faster, get going faster, operate better, and potentially with fewer resources. So I think with AI you can set up kind of better inventory management, better predict usage, look at how people are, what people are consuming, how often, who's coming back, who's not, and use kind of machine learning algorithms. And by the way, like these, so far, I'm not even talking about LLM. This is AI stuff that's been around for a while, right? And for example, there are multiple companies that use AI, like predictive AI, to recommend the next bottle for each customer. right? So you can license that software or start using it and then provide kind of more individualized, customized recommendations for each customer. You can use AI, including LLM, to do kind of marketing, to do social media marketing. Maybe you can use chatbots and virtual assistants, but also, if you have a wine store and then you have a state-of-the-art e-commerce website, right, then you could start distributing, not distributing, but reaching customers across the country. Now, from one little store, you can actually do a lot more business. And maybe you do things like dynamic pricing. Maybe you do things like now that there's social media and you can get messages out quickly, maybe you can do 24-hour deals, right? Steep discounts for 24 hours. And then you can use technology to get feedback from your customers. Actually, so I did a survey using SurveyMonkey with friends, and then later on today, I'm gonna post something on LinkedIn where I'm using technology, LLM-based technology from some friends of mine to ask my LinkedIn connections to provide feedback on how they buy wine and compare the results. So now, people are having this conversation with an AI, and providing their feedback on how they like to explore wine, buy wine, all of that stuff. And then I think, with AI, you can do, you can better predict kind of supply chain efficiency and maybe have less, inventory, right? Think about inventory for a wine store. I mean, it can easily get into a couple of hundred thousand dollars, if
Easy.
not more, right? So if you can optimize that, then you can save yourself a lot of money.
Absolutely.
I think it's kind of the same as large companies, except potentially the impact is greater because you're starting off from a small base and then.
No, it's, and I'm sure it can also be applied to, production and to help predict different conditions in maybe different soil. I'm not sure if it can, if you could, use it to run analytics on what soil, what grapes would grow best in what soil for to create different things, but I'm not sure. I'm just not sure how, like, how it could be applied to that process. I know it already is.
So we spent a lot of time talking about satellite imagery, and it was mostly referring to electro-optical, RGB, the rays we can see, red, green, and blue. That's what RGB is, right? But there's a whole crop of new companies, satellite companies, that are doing hyperspectral imagery. They're capturing rays in parts of the spectrum that our eye cannot see. And actually, that is really effective at measuring the health of plants, the health of soil, or whether it's dry or so. There are applications today where in agriculture, where people, farmers are looking at this data to determine how dry the soil is, whether their plants are healthy. So, and that uses a lot of AI as well. So that's happening today. And that's just gonna keep developing because there's gonna be more, there's just gonna be more hyperspectral imagery. And I hope that, it'll be available in a way that can help kind of vineyards.
Absolutely. That was nice.
And I think they can apply all kinds of additional AI to just kind of improve things like managing their environmental impact or diseases or stuff like that. What's interesting in the wine business is it's cyclical in kind of in a way that I've never seen before, because you need to plant a vine. You don't get useful grapes from it for 3 or 4 years, right? Because you want the roots to be deep enough that they're extracting minerals from the soil, multiple layers of soil. And then you produce the wine, and then you gotta age it for like a year or so. So there's a big gap between production and consumption. And consumption appears to be slowing down at this point, but production has not. Actually, France, they're pulling out some vines
Really?
just to kind of maintain more of a balance.
Hmm.
So anyway, so there's this kind of there's this big gap. They're not able to respond to, let's say, increased or decreased demand immediately.
Yep.
So maybe AI can help with that as well. When I'm looking at wine, I mean, when I was younger, I used to always say, oh, I want to own a winery when I'm older. Owning a winery is really tough. So I've been looking more at the import distribution retail side of things,
Absolutely.
and I think those are kind of less, that gap in the cycle is kind of less severe for those guys than it is for producers, because at the end of the day, producers just have to reduce their prices.
Absolutely. No, and it'll be interesting to see kind of how demand go changes. I think it always changes, but I've seen, I know, I mean, the bourbon industry or whiskey industry is very similar in that you can't, and well, it's a little, but it's a lot longer. So like you can't change what you made 15 years ago for this 15-year-old, that you've had sit like, and if demand triples or quadruples, you just get to raise your prices. Because that's the only thing that you can control other than put more down more now, but who knows where you'll be in 15 years, right? So
Right.
no, it's really, really fascinating. And then do you think you can all go ahead?
But by the way, I am amazed that no one's figured out how to age whiskey or wine more quickly.
They have figured out how to age whiskey more quickly. Specific, and like so the whiskey, it ages, obviously it goes into the barrel clear, right? And the aging process is getting sucked into the barrel as temperatures rise and the barrel expands. It sucks the whiskey into the barrel, and then that pushes it back out when it gets colder. And so interestingly, Scotland is a one of the reasons that things need to age for so long in Scotland is because of there isn't a massive temperature variance on a daily basis. So the process takes longer because the barrel is expanding and contracting less. If you are in an area with, and it's not hotter, it's where there's more time, like there is a bigger temperature swing, it's going to essentially age faster. So you look at like a Kentucky where it's 105 during the day in the summer, 100 degrees, and then it goes down to 80, right? That's a 20 degree swing, and so that's a little bit better. But because of that, like there's some whiskeys coming out of India and Southeast Asia that are phenomenal, and they also don't need to be in the barrel as long because they like they're just because of the wrap, because of how the temperature works, they're gonna be over oaked at a faster rate.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. It's like,
But then the question is, could you do that in a couple of months instead of several years?
I think so.
using pressure variations and temperature variations. And I haven't studied this. I'm just surprised that there
It's
have been.
also so it's there's also a lot that can be done by a, like the barrel not moving versus the barrel being moved around, like when it's like when as it's moving and the liquid is moving around inside of it, it's going that's going to change how it interacts with the barrel. There's actually Jefferson Bourbon, I think they're still doing it. They had the Voyager series where they essentially they take their barrels of bourbon and they buy containers on container ships and put them in the containers, and then it travels on the oceans all over the like in throughout the world, and they have different voyage numbers. You can like go and see, oh, this one went, you can see where the whiskey went throughout the world. And they got the idea because during like a long time ago, it's mimicking the barrel, or it's imitating the barrels, because they used to move up and down the Mississippi all the time, right? They'd move them up and down the Mississippi on boats, and they're like, well, let's do that, but like globally. And so there's that whole program that they've been doing. So yeah, it's really interesting.
Can you taste the seawater? Can you taste like salt
No,
in
but
it?
I have a bourbon downstairs that tastes a little bit like seawater. You should come over and try some. Yeah, man, I don't know if I told you. I have like 400 bottles of whiskey in my house, and I'm not even exaggerating.
Wow.
Yeah,
Yeah, I like whiskey, not that much.
I mean,
I have
listen.
five or six bottles.
Some people baked bread during COVID. I bought whiskey. I also started a mental health company. I swear they're not related, but so yeah, man, it's that it was that
Is
was
some of
absolutely.
that whiskey an investment?
No, I didn't. I've never bought whiskey to. I don't think. I think that's like spirits, whether it's like nice whiskey or it's wine. I don't feel this way about beer, but I feel like there's love put into the production process. It's an
Yes.
art form. People dedicate their lives to it, and I just don't like. I don't view that as an investment or a sellable asset. I buy it to enjoy it, and I give to my friends, I share with people. I mean, that's just who I am, man. Is like I've always, I want to consume that, and I want to consume it with people that I care about and in environments that are fun. Pair it with a great cigar, have a good time,
But what you just said about whiskey is, I agree with, and that's one of the reasons I like wine. It's because it's art and science. It's something that people produce with love. It's something that people enjoy consuming. And I think with AI, you can kind of and it's full of small producers, right? So with AI, you can discover new, small, interesting, whatever brands much more effectively than you could in the past.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's increased accessibility, right? And I think, I think that there's a huge, I think obviously, people are already doing it from a software perspective of like predictions on taste and things like that and what you're gonna like next. But I think that as there's more available data and more small producers, right? Because they keep popping up all over the place. I mean, Virginia has some good wineries. Some really good wine is made here. I was actually speaking of AI and the wine production process, I went to a vineyard and they have a so they obviously as they harvest grapes and they're going through, they sort them, and some they don't like, they pass the test to be made in the wine, right? They got to look right, they got to touch, and they run all of their grapes through a machine that analyzes the grapes on like I don't remember exactly what level, but it looks at them all really closely And it ones that are not up to their standard, it has like an air gun, and the machine will target the grape and then pop it and blow the grape right off the production line. And stuff like that is really cool because, like, it gives you the ability to increase quality in a way that you can't do by hand. If
And it's computer vision. It's the same as the stuff we talked about earlier, right? With identifying airplanes and ships and stuff.
No, it's really cool, and it's really, really exciting, man. It'll be really interesting to see kind of how this continues to evolve. I think that, AI, if implemented correctly, is has the ability to, like, I mean, at a societal level, has the ability to help us, I mean, spend less time doing menial tasks and improve things, but it also, I mean, it's double-edged, right? And so I always think about that. Yeah, man, before we wrap up, Nick, man, anything else you want to add? Any other points that you want to make? Anything that I didn't touch on?
No, not at this point. I love all the businesses you're involved in. No, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I think AI is a fascinating topic, and I think it's got it's an opportunity to kind of accelerate a whole bunch of things. There are some risks, but we'll deal with the risks.
I mean, nothing ventured, nothing gained, right?
Right.
Let's roll. We gotta roll the dice sometimes. But man, I really appreciate you coming on, Nick. Thank you as always, and thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape, everybody.